I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Are we mic'd up?
We
mic'd up. Is it working? Yeah. Good. Well, good evening, and thank you for coming. So I'm going to be a sort of ringmaster for this evening. I'm going to be saying a little bit about my book, really because this will be a sort of chassis to hang Beethoven's life on and provide a sort of structure for talking about him. Because my two colleagues here have both been commissioned to do poems around Beethoven. I'm really keen to hear what they say and to read them. But I thought I'd start by saying a little bit about why I wrote this book, which is a quartet, really, of four movements of his life. He was born in 1770. The first movement is 12 poems, is 1770 to 1800, more or less. And then from when he went to Vienna, he was born in Bonn, in an outpost of the Holy Roman Empire. Then from 21 to 31, he was in his first phase of life as a virtuoso pianist, really, in Vienna, and beginning to write what everybody calls his early phase, his first phase, of his first style. At the end of that time, before he was 30, he began to realize that he was going deaf. He went deaf in a lot of different stages, but this was agonizing for him. So his first big crisis is 1802, when he considers whether he's going to kill himself. Because how can a musician in such a competitive musical town, how can a musician live? And as you'll hear in one of these poems, he decides to live for his art. He goes back and immediately he writes the Eroica Symphony, the Hero's Symphony, and this inaugurates an extraordinary decade of writing really most of the music that we all know as Beethoven. And he goes up to the 7th, 8th symphony, the piano concertos, most of the great violin sonatas, cello sonatas. And then 1812, he has another crisis. And partly that coincides with the sort of, as it were, climax of his tragic and unfulfilled love life. The immortal beloved, we don't know who she was, something happens, he writes a devastated letter, and then he goes into the third period, which starts off with 6 barren, miserable years in which he's practically not writing anything. And then suddenly there is the late flowering of the extraordinary last music, the Missa Solemnis, the 9th symphony, which I think Anthony will be talking a bit about, and the late quartets. So I'm just going to start by reading a couple of poems from the early period, and then I want to ask Ray and Anthony about what they've done, and then we'll come back to sort of finish him off, really. We haven't got any music. You'll have to carry the music in your heads or go home afterwards. But a lot of my poems reference the music. But I wanted to start. I think I had 3 things that I wanted to ask myself. First of all, how did this scruffy little boy, pockmarked, son of an alcoholic, how did he come to write these extraordinary things and have, you know, by the time he died, all the schools in Vienna were closed, 10,000 people followed his funeral. How did that happen? How did it happen that this boy radicalized music in a way more in Western music more than anybody, even Stockhausen? Beethoven changed things in the most radical, surprising way. And also, how did it happen that somebody who had very explosive, complicated, difficult, thorny, upsetting relationships with people managed to write music in which the voices are such in such amazing relationship to each other? And I suppose that was how my journey of writing. So this one is called If Your Father Damaged You. The way meteorites spin in, clustering on Antarctic ice. Bare shields of glacier burnished by ferocious wind, because your father is magnetite, dragging all the iron in your soul into his own force field. You seal yourself in. You need nothing but music. Your answer to obstruction will be fire. In the little hall of the house where you were born, the one original surface is dark silver flagstones where you might have crawled. Light falls in shallow hollows of deciduous rubbed stone clogged with spume of cleaning fluid, where I imagine your mother carrying the shopping, your father staggering home drunk up these stairs, their new cut wood now polished to the amber shine of a harvest moon, to wake you in the middle of the night, stand you for hours on a bench so you can reach the keys. You cry as you play, slapped if you make a mistake. In daylight, he hears you improvise, splashing around, he calls it, on a violin. What rubbish are you scratching now? Isn't that beautiful? No, you made it up. You're not to do that. Stop or I'll box your ears. If your father damaged you, the way fierce winds scour glacier ice where meteorites have fallen from heaven, but he was the one who made you, beat the notes into you on the clavier, viola, violin, your response to challenge ever after will be attack. You will need no one. Only the relationship of sound and key. You improvise. So I'm just going to read one more short poem. This is from his first crisis when he has to accept he's going deaf. He kept it quiet. He didn't tell his friends. He went to a few doctors who gave him daft things, like one doctor bound poisonous bark around his upper arms, then left it for a while until the pus came, lanced the pus and said, there, that is all the fluid that is blocking your ears, it's coming out of your arms. Another one put burning herbs on his stomach. So that was the level of treatment he had. But one sensible doctor said, go and rest your ears for 6 months outside Vienna. So he went into a little town called, rather heartbreakingly, Heiligenstadt, which of course means holy city. He was there for 6 months, but by October he realized it wasn't going to work. And there's a heartrending document called the Heiligenstadt Testament in which he wrote a letter on the 6th of October, 1802, ostensibly to his brothers, but also to all humanity, because he knew, he was under 31, he knew that he had all this extraordinary stuff in him, and he wanted to give it to humanity. And that, again, underlies the Ode to Joy, which he will come out with at the end of his life. Five of this called, Until It Please the Fates to Break the Thread. Five full moons, five waning moons, touches of chill in the autumn night, dying vine leaves, purple as the pulse vein in his wrist. The woods yellow, then black and bare. The candle trembles in a draft. Shutters swing in silence, like the sea breathing through glass. He cannot hear the driving rain. But he's sketching a funeral march, a symphony. I have taken a new path. So even at that moment of despair, what was stirring in him was the Eroica symphony, his breakthrough symphony into the new style, the style, the hero's style. So I want to stop his life there, because I want to now to turn to Antony. And Antony, would you like to be saying what you've been doing, the special extraordinary Beethoven project, unique, that you've been doing all year?
So I was asked by the South Bank last year if I'd be interested in rewriting Ode to Joy to mark Beethoven's 250th anniversary at the South Bank, that's going to happen in April of this year. And when I sat down with the good folk there, I said, I'm not really that familiar with the good Beethoven's work. Obviously, I know his music because I listen to Classic FM whenever I feel like it. But I don't really feel confident enough to kind of take on something of this magnitude. And they said, that's absolutely fine. You're the perfect guy for this job. And so I said to them, what I'd like to do is, rather than literally just giving kind of my take on Schiller's Ode to Joy, would be to try and give it a more contemporary feel and focus on some of the sensibilities that are evident in the poem and how we can make them relevant today, particularly thinking about the political climate, nationalism, division, Brexit, so on and so forth. So I kind of said I wanted to have elements of Arabic and Mandarin and Urdu in the poem, like kind of take those words, and they were all for it. And so I said, I also want to work with young people, refugees, as well as people from local state schools in London, and ask them, what does joy mean to them? And get responses. What does joy mean to somebody living in Finsbury Park, or somebody who's come from a war in the Middle East? What does joy mean? And so I did that with 12 different groups from August to November. And then I took elements of what they responded with and built them into the poem as well, that I wrote over kind of from November till January. The difficulty that I found with writing it was a number of things. I'm not used to writing around music, so there was quite a lot of constriction syllabically, as kind of prosody as well, where you can actually go. So I worked with a director and I worked with a songwriter to try and have sounds, vowels, fit in certain places that I'd never had to think about as a poet writing in a book. Like, you don't think about these things. You think about the musicality of language, but never around those kind of elements. And so the Arabic and the Urdu stuff that I wanted, we couldn't find the translator in time because we were working to time lapse. So those bits didn't make it in. So we ended up keeping it with the English. But there was a lot of, there's some colloquialism that we've put in there as well. So I say people them, and they said, this is a typo. You've made them. I said, nah, they said, is it people them? And I was like, no, it's people them, as in the people. And they were just like, oh, okay, interesting. Yeah, no, we'll go with it. And so I kind of feel that we were doing that kind of thing. But as a whole, it was really quite fun. And the poem is looking at plurality. It's looking as us. I called it Oh Human. It's quite male-centric, the Schiller version, in the way that, you know, man symbolised all of humanity. So I kind of took all that nonsense out and just had it in regards to humanity and the different things that we represent as people.
So what sort of insights did you get into why Beethoven might have chosen that poem to for his sort of final statement of what he wanted to give humanity?
But I think it's just exactly, I mean, the kind of political climate of his time was quite similar to what we had now. So I kind of feel that as a gesture, it was really quite, Freud, like, it was really quite important to have that being put out there. And to think about it in the context of its time, it was doing that thing. It was showing solidarity. It was trying to bring people together in quite tenuous and volatile spaces.
Mm. Because that was when he wrote the he took a long time to write the Ninth Symphony, and it was actually commissioned from London, by London, and he conducted it, and he thought he conducted it, and he threw his arms around and he was in front of the orchestra, but the real conductor was behind, and he didn't realise when they'd finished because he couldn't hear, and everybody burst into applause. And the alto soloist gently turned him round to show him everybody just, So it really, it was a sort of apocalyptic moment.
And didn't they start using handkerchiefs after that to show to show applause or something? I mean, they told me this when we were doing the research on it, and they said that story. Then they said after that they started using handkerchiefs to show. I think now we use jazz hands, right? Something like, which is when people, so I kind of feel, that kind of thing, So I kind of feel that. They started doing handkerchiefs to show where there was applause, but I mean, it was an interesting project, and I'm excited to have it. So there's 200 National Youth Orchestra are going to be singing it in April in the Royal Festival Hall. Tickets have gone on sale, so if you guys want to come and see what we've done, like that will be.
Yeah, I think we can't hear it tonight because it's embargoed. Yes. So you'll just have to get the tickets. So Ray, what about you? Because you were also commissioned to write some poems about Beethoven, and you picked something very, very special.
Yeah, I was asked by the Barbican to write about Beethoven because it's 250 years since his birth. And at first I said no, for a similar reason as Anthony. I didn't feel a particular kinship about Beethoven. You know, Beethoven, the main thing about him in terms of the mythology of the man was that he's this man who was deafened and overcame it. And he's used as this kind of example of, even if you're deaf, you can blah, blah, blah. And I'm just not interested in those narratives, but what I decided to do is, because I knew he wrote letters, I every now and then I read people's letters. And so I went to his letters and I read 6 years of his letters. And within that time, from 1801 to 1806, and I came across a concert that Beethoven gave in Vienna with a man called George Polgreen Bridgetower. And the way that he wrote about this man, George Polgreen Bridgetower, there's this whole story there. You know, I'm sure you know about it. And then I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. Like, I've never heard of this man. He's born in Poland, has a Caribbean father, just kind of hailed as one of the great violinists of his time, but completely erased by history. And then I find out that he's buried in London. He's in Peckham. And I go and I look for his grave. And so kind of... Beethoven became a catalyst for this kind of forgotten musician, and that's who I chose to focus on. I mean, I went back to the Barbican and I said, do you mind if I take this on? You know, it starts with Beethoven, but I want to look at this man. I think this is interesting. And they hadn't heard of him either.
That's disgraceful.
And
I mean, he was, well, but you're going to, are they going to do the Kreutzer Sonata with it?
I've done it already. I've read like all I'm doing. Oh, so it's not even a project. I'm just, I just wrote two poems and that's me done.
Over here.
This is the poem I wrote, going to Kensal Green Cemetery, I suppose. And, some of the stories that's behind that I'll feed in. I mean, we'll have a discussion in a way, won't we? George Polgreen Bridgetower. And I've written the title because his name is faded from his grave. It's a completely kind of abandoned grave. At Kensal Green Cemetery, I walk each green stone path between chapel and tomb, past graves with hovering helium balloons, past a woman in shorts and vests in December freeze, scrubbing tombstones like the backs of tired fathers. In the cemetery office, I ask for Bridgetower, composer and violinist, lived in Peckham and lies at rest here, black, Polish, British, played with Beethoven. Beethoven. The name lit all the desks and directed me to the Anglican Chapel. At the Anglican Chapel, English writers, composers, philosophers, priests, painters, but no Bridgetower. I walk off the path, a small withered plaque, no celebrations or balloons, no mention in the notable graves, an eroded name, an audience of shade. And so when I found out more about kind of what had happened between Bridgetower, I found this Beethoven. I just want to read a footnote, which was in the letters. In 1803, a 32-year-old Beethoven met 22-year-old George Polgreen Bridgetower, quote, great mulatto composer and lunatic in Vienna. Beethoven wrote Sonata No. 9, Op. 47 for Bridgetower, and they played as a duet at the Argentin Theatre. They'd only had one rehearsal, and Bridgetower modified parts of the composition during the performance, which had Beethoven rising from his piano, yelling, again, my dear fellow! But after a falling out over a, quote, unnamed woman, Beethoven erased Bridgetower from the sonata and dedicated it instead to Rudolf Kreutzer.
Kreutzer.
And he was hailed as the greatest violinist of his time, who rendered the sonata, quote, outrageously unintelligible. During this time, no one in the public knew that Beethoven had lost 60% of his hearing, and he was trying to keep it a secret. And I found that a really interesting detail, because all we have about this man, George Polgreen Bridgetower, is kind of what how Beethoven wrote about him in his letters, about this kind of interaction that happened between him and this woman. And the way he writes about him, unfortunately, that the language is quite difficult. I mean, to say that he called him primitive would be a polite way to put it. But I've written a poem trying to, I guess, imagine George Polgreen's kind of account, because there's no record of it. So this is just kind of written in his voice, pieced together based on Beethoven's letter. He didn't say much to black boys, even after my strings brightened the famous Argentin Theatre. We brought Vienna to the edge of something that made me mythic, a lunatic mulatto. After one encore, we stood and he went silent. I wondered how he lost the jubilance that jumped out his letters to me, and if he knew how to speak outside music. I was 22 and fresh to city nights. When we drank in the tavern, I slipped my hands under some skirt while Beethoven sat looking like I'd wronged his note. Then we went to rehearse, and even though he never spoke, I noticed clouds of scolding fathers quietly gathering in his gravity. I wish I'd paid attention to the shadows in that room, for I would never leave its corners, not in Vienna, Paris, not in Rome or London. Not my fault that he wasn't what women want, but they called me Prince to his face of smashed keys. Of course, I was mawed, Othello'd, caught in myths, but I knew how to fiddle then for what I wanted. I'm forgotten, but no one forgets Beethoven storming into the night. I screech his name, but until it burst my mouth and shook the street. But he didn't hear. He didn't hear.
Oh. He was an extraordinary man. He was very, very gifted. And he was born in Poland, but then was taken up by the Prince of Wales. And so he worked, and then he went to Trinity Hall in Cambridge. They've got a room named after him. And so when he arrived, Beethoven must have been so surprised. And then he was so surprised by what he did, the improvising, which was very similar to what he did himself. So there must have been, when I read that story, I felt there must have been some sort of identification from Beethoven, who was very dark as a child and was called a Spaniard. And so, you know, he must have felt some sort of mode of embrace with him. And then whatever happened with this woman, there was also Beethoven's revulsion of whatever.
Yeah, we don't know. I didn't want to write something that would glorify George Bridgetower, because he might have been an asshole, you know what I mean? He might have been like a misogynist, and Beethoven might have actually done the right thing. We just won't know. There's no way to know.
No, it's fascinating. But also, he was obviously a brilliant violinist. And I think it speaks to another thing in Beethoven, that Beethoven always had this tendency to idealize what he couldn't have and what he couldn't see in somebody who was distant.
Yeah.
So to the distant beloved, for instance.
Yeah.
And so he sent it off to Kreutzer, whom he'd never met in Paris. Mm. And Kreutzer just disdained it. And I think he didn't even send it back.
No. Yeah. Yeah.
So what insights did you both have, or artistic insights, or any sense of identifying with any part of Beethoven as a writer, as a composer?
I think the music, obviously, I mean, when I write poetry, I work around music a lot of the time, but that's not to set poems to music. It's more to kind of get in a space. But, I particularly felt a connection with Ode to Joy in that a lot of the poems that I've written over the years, some critics of the things that I've written have argued that they have a kind of a moral drive. And I kind of felt that Schiller's poem definitely had like a morality to it. It was a moralizing poem. And I kind of feel that with where we are, like I said, where we are as a kind of, as a nation, it's important to have poetry kind of come back and take that role again and use language to bring people together, seeing as language has done so well at pulling a country apart over the last couple of years. So I kind of feel that it was a gesture and a symbol towards that, which I felt was apposite in the way that poetry and humanity can come together.
That's interesting, because when I was doing it and going to Bonn and then Vienna, and that was sort of a year and a half ago, and we didn't know what was going to happen about Brexit then, but I was thinking that when he was born and the French, well, when he was a teenager, the French Revolution happened. And he was all for it, because he was all for revolution and getting rid of the old framework and so on. But then he was horrified when Napoleon was occupying Vienna. And when Napoleon crowned himself an emperor, he thought the same thing was coming back.
Yeah.
So I felt Europe was breaking up then, and maybe it's breaking up now.
But I think that, yeah, obviously the difference is that Simon Bolivar as well, had the same thing with Napoleon, was when he saw his megalomania, he no longer saw him as something that he wanted to aspire to, although Bolivar was pretty megalomaniac in his kind of, in his later days. But I think it's interesting that did anyone watch the Frankie Boyle thing, the documentary, where they had a historian on there that was saying that England never had a revolution in the way that the French have had. So the French Revolution obviously did something that set, whereas we've never had that here.
Yeah.
So it's really, I'd never really thought of it in that kind of way. It was quite interesting.
What about you, Ray? Were there things that you identified with as an artist, somebody who's, you know, the struggle to compose, the struggle, of course, you know, it's not only composing, it's also performing.
Yeah. Turns out that, you know, Beethoven does actually come to terms with his deafness, then that's not really spoken about much in an interesting way. I think, I really, you know, actually one of the things I really enjoyed discovering were the conversation pieces. So in the last, when he went completely almost, you know, profoundly deaf, he could only have
conversation books.
Conversations through, conversation books. So getting to see some of those conversation books is really cool. So with people who he struggled to communicate with, you would write in them. So basically it's a whole book of just half a conversation. I found that intriguing, and I couldn't do anything but it was interesting. One of the things that I think I was looking at as well was, so there's, you know, thinking about deaf, classical, canonized, iconic people. There's Beethoven, but then there's Goya, and they both occupy that same space. So Goya, interestingly, because he's in Spain, he learned sign language when he went deaf, so he could still connect with people, and people were still signing. But and that was always the kind of thing with the narrative of Beethoven, is that it was so kind of hearing centric, it was doom. It was just, there's no way back for me. I was thinking a lot through that. But I came out of that thinking Beethoven's, he's all right. Actually, no. I'll tell you a story. I visited a deaf school in Hertfordshire, and half of this school is named after Beethoven. It's called Beethoven House. And I went there and I gave a ceremony, and they asked me about Beethoven, and you know, we spoke, and I'm speaking with 50 British deaf young people. And after the assembly, the teacher says, you know, we need to kind of modernize. We need more kind of deaf icons to kind of take this place. So they emailed me about 2 months later, and they said, we've changed the name of our school from Beethoven House to Antrobus House. And so now I've got this school in Beethoven, like, kind of. And so they sent me this picture of Beethoven's name coming down and Antrobus's name going, you know. That's one thing I'm going to kind of really, an image that stayed with me with Beethoven. There you go.
So, well, if you go to the place where he wrote that Heiligenstadt Testament, there's a wonderful museum. Have you been there?
I have not, no.
Well, it's a heartbreaking sort of picture of the ways he tried to hear. And one of them is you get a stick which you put on your forehead and you attach it to the piano, and you can somehow hear through the bone of your... apart from the ear trumpets and all sorts of other things. He tried everything. Okay, so...
I mean, just to say, there's so many ridiculous myths about Beethoven, like the things about how, oh, he had to lie on the floor and compose so he could feel the vibration. It just ties into a lot of kind of misinformation about the being of deafness, I thought. But there is a lot of really great discussion about it too. And I was relieved to find there were things in Beethoven where he claimed it. There were moments in his letters when he says, no, maybe this has given me this gift. I couldn't be who I am without this.
Yeah, I do recommend the Beethoven's letters are extraordinarily interesting.
Yeah, there's some interesting stuff there, yeah.
But there's also an interesting idea that when he was a little boy, sometimes he went into a complete trance of concentration, which his first patron, who was a sort of a cultured, rich woman in Bonn, called his raptus. And he said once, excuse me, I couldn't answer. I was in such a deep thought. I didn't want to be disturbed. And so it has been suggested that sort of practice of going into that kind of trance from very early, sort of under 10, possibly it established some sort of neurosynapses in his brain so that he could actually go into himself and make use of being in himself without relating to the outside world, which was possibly of use for him when he did go deaf. It was a sort of preparation in a way. Mm. Anyway, I'll finish by reading just a couple of poems in his later life. This is after he's lost the immortal beloved, whoever she was, and while he feels he's lost the path of how he's writing. He's finished up his heroic phase, and he's gone into this barren period from 1812, 1813 on. And I quote from one of his journals. He kept a journal in his 40s for about sort of 6 years. This is called 3 Days. Oh God, give me strength to conquer myself. Nothing at all must fetter me to life. Oh terrible circumstances that do not suppress my feeling for domesticity, but prevent its realization. Oh God, God, look down upon this unhappy bee. Do not let it go on much longer in this way. And that's two entries in his journal, 1812, 1813. And I ought to say that, you know, his friend said he was always in love from a teenager and usually very much affected by the love he was in at the time. But all the loves always went wrong. And so this is just called 3 Days, and it's really reacting to that. It almost embarrassed me that because of his fame and his eccentricity and his wonderfulness, so much of his what he wrote has been kept. And really, if you, well, you'll hear, we shouldn't be reading this. A self-help diary, the voice of loneliness and struggle. Nothing can stop him tipping into the abyss, afraid that everything he could create will stay locked in forever. He doesn't know where to go or what to write. He stays with a friend outside the city, a paradise of elm and oak, cool mosses, sun, and at night the blowing net of stars. But he vanishes without a word. They think he's left. 3 days go by, and the music master tracks him down to a corner of the grounds, huddling like a wolf crawled off to lick its wounds, trying, he explains, to starve himself to death. So that's an extraordinary moment in his life. And now I'll read the last poem, which I call Musica Humana. When he, one enormous relationship we've left out is the relationship with really the only person he tried to live with for any length of time, which was his nephew. One of his brothers had this boy and died, and there was a huge court case about him with the mother, but eventually Beethoven managed to adopt him after 5 years. The poor boy was 9 when his father died and about 14 when Beethoven finally got him. And he wanted him to call him father, and it just went appallingly wrong. And when he was in his first year at college, he put 2 bullets into his brain. He didn't manage to kill himself, but he did manage to get himself into hospital, and finally he got away from Beethoven. And he said he did it to get away from his uncle's harassment. And Beethoven was by turn appallingly horrible to him and cloyingly possessive about him and saying, my dear son, and everything like that. So you can see this boy did survive, it wasn't great, put it like that. And then finally, he took about 3 months to die. He had dropsy. He had all sorts of other things, as well as being deaf. His belly was distended 3 times. The doctor put a hole in it, and water, or whatever it was, gushed out over the floor. And he was extraordinarily stoical about that. And in the end, very, very gentle. And Musica Humana. And he writes to one of his very old childhood friends from his bed, I still hope to create a few great works and then, like an old child, finish my earthly course somewhere among kind people. The auditory canal, covered in glutinous scales, shining throughout the autopsy. The auditory arteries, thick and cartilaginous, as if stretched over a raven's quill. And the auditory nerve, withered to a pure white strand. But, reading the last page in the book of his life on earth, how he joked to the doctor who lanced his belly, gallons of fluid gushing across the floor. You remind me of Moses striking the rock with his staff. How he laughed when he could. How he read and reread with great joy, he said, a final gift, a 40-volume set of all the works of Handel. And how he died lifting his fist as if it held a bird he would release into the storm pelting Vienna with snow, like the reckless feathers driving all our lives to seek the fullest experience of the air. I listen to Cello Sonata Opus 69 and hear the unquenchable spirit that powers every note he writes and lives on, dancing, dancing in you, me, everyone. So now I think we can have questions. There is a roving mic, so just put up your hands and any questions.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Just to see what we've got. Okay, yeah.
What I wanted to say, Beethoven's text for the Ode to Joy was similar but not identical to Schiller's original text in that certain words had to be changed.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think that
that's true.
I think that should be also explained.
Thank you so much. Yes. You found that, didn't you?
Yeah, I found that out to be true. There were several different renditions and translations of the original, but obviously because it was being set to music, he did have to adopt some of the language and change some of the words around in order to fit it. In fact, Tracy K. Smith, the American poet laureate, has got an amazing version of Ode to Joy. If anyone's interested in reading it, it's up online, and you can
see. That's lovely. Yeah. Actually, one of the things I discovered was that we haven't mentioned his early childhood and everything, but he was taught by a wonderful organist who was a member of the Illuminati. I'm sure there are people here who know this much better than me, actually. But a member of the Illuminati, which was a kind of slightly Mason-like group. The Ode to Joy was...
We're Illuminati.
You're Illuminati.
Don't tell them that. Great.
Well, but apparently the Ode to Joy was often set to music for different people.
Yeah.
Then, anyway, another question.
Hi. Firstly, thank you for the readings, and I've really enjoyed them and talking about your works that you can't read yet. You've all come to know Beethoven very well through your research and just being sort of studying him. What do you think? And particularly his character, what do you think he would say if somebody told him 250 years from his birthday we'd all be enjoying poetry with a glass of wine in London, listening to poetry about him?
I think he'd say, why aren't you listening to the damn music? What do you think?
What was the question?
What do you think he'd say when he was told that 250 years after his birth we'd all be listening and writing poetry about him with a glass of wine in London?
You go.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, just go on. So, I don't know. You could ask anything. What wine is it? Is it good? I don't know. It's just because you think you've got the narcissistic answer, and then you've got the other answer. So I kind of feel it depends what mood someone's in. I mean, if any of us were in 250 years' time, anyone's thinking or reading or writing what we're doing, then who knows what the answer would be. I don't know, it just depends on the mood, I guess.
He did love wine, and yeah. and he was very, and one of the very touching things of these 3 months, from January to March 1827, he asked for a crate of Rhine wine, because he left the Rhineland, which is where he was born. He always kept his Rhineland accent, and they sent it, but too late. And he said, pity, too late, and they gave him a little spoonful.
Yeah.
But he did like red wine. He did like a little. Yeah, question.
I want to ask two aspects of this question. Were you all listening to his music as you write? I mean, that's hard to do anyway, because it's distracting. But do you see the writing and the work you're doing as parallel to the music? Or somehow interacting with it in some way? What is it doing for you? Could you write your wonderful works, and thank you very much for that, without hearing the music?
Well, it's very different for Ray and me. For Anthony had to write words to the music.
So, words that already existed. And that's what was difficult, because it was such a constraint. One, taking words that already existed and then trying to add a kind of contemporary flavour to those words, but also working within the musical notations as well. So there were so many barriers that I felt that I was going up against. I had a word, and the director was like, nah, it needs to be ba-ba-ba-bum. And I was like, oh. So I had to try and find the word that went ba-ba-ba-bum. You know? And so you're kind of working.
Yeah, that is a difference.
It's completely different from just whacking out a book. Yeah. Yeah.
What about you, Uwe?
I mean, because I just focus on the man rather than the music, if I'm honest. I was just interested in, you know, the kind of things, what he was like, you know, because we know about his famous temperament. But actually, one of the things I forgot to mention was what a tender teacher he was. Mm. And there were so many testimonies of people just saying, you know, I have this memory of being this child, and Beethoven had requested to see, you know, who are the best musicians of the day. And he's, you know, being shown these young kind of prodigies of their instruments, and almost so many of the testimonies were like, you know, I sat there, Beethoven didn't even look at me, stared out the window, and I was so nervous, I thought he was either going to hit me or kiss me. I couldn't tell which one was going to come. But all the time it was like, you are fantastic, you're genius. You know, that was a real something. I don't know, there was an energy in that kind of helped, brought me to him as a person. I know your question's about the music, though. Yeah. My relationship with the music isn't what's come out of the work.
No, with me, I was brought up as a viola player, which Beethoven also was. So I played Beethoven chamber music when I was a child, and also sang in some things. So I knew a lot of the music very intimately, and I had to slightly keep it out, but because music gets in your way when you're writing.
Yeah.
The one bits of music that I didn't know were three trombone quartets that he wrote just after he left or whatever happened with the Immortal Beloved, and I listened to them over and over again. They haven't got an opus number. They are words that there are pieces called WOO, works ohne Oper, without an opus number, and then they have a number. I mean, I don't know. So they're one of those. But these extraordinary quartets, and they are amazing. And he wrote them in 1812 in November for All Souls Night. And they were, I think they're a kind of funeral of love. He didn't love anybody else afterwards. And so I did keep writing when I was listening to those, just those little three little pieces. But that was for one poem. Hmm. Yeah. One more question, and I think otherwise, maybe two. Yeah.
We know why you guys have written about Beethoven, but Ruth, why did you want to write a whole collection about Beethoven's life?
Okay, so this book actually started 5 years ago when I was commissioned to write poems for the interval of a quartet concert between one of the early quartets, which he wrote when he was going deaf and not telling anybody, and one of the wonderful late quartets. And I loved working with that quartet. I'd already worked with them. And then I was setting myself the task of discovering how somebody who was a young man, not yet 30, and who was writing in the classical style and had not written quartets before, what was the journey from that young man to the tormented but fulfilled extraordinary artist who wrote the late quartets. And so I didn't really know. I wrote those. I didn't think they were perfect poems, but it worked as a concert with the quartet. And then I went on working with that quartet, and I did some with Schubert. And then I suggested to my editor, maybe I could do Beethoven and Schubert together. And we'd call it the Divine Spark, because Schubert was much younger than Beethoven. And there is a story that some of his music was given to Beethoven on his deathbed, practically, and Beethoven said, this young man has a divine spark. But tragically, Schubert died the next year, so himself. So I thought, and then I went to Bonn, and this is now 18 months ago, And then I realized that, A, there was much too much stuff on Beethoven to add Schubert to it, and Schubert ought to have something of his own anyway. And B, that there was this 250th anniversary coming up, so I better get a move on. And then I thought, well, I'll do Beethoven's life in that sort of curve. And then Beethoven just completely took me over. But also, I put some of myself in it because I'm the viola player. And from the age of 10, his father took him out of school and put him into the court orchestra playing viola. So I realized I'd grown up playing a lot of orchestral parts, which Beethoven had grown up playing too. And that was sort of exciting, yeah. I think one more question. Yes, Nicola. Yes.
I was really interested in what you were saying about overcoming narrative, the narrative of overcoming deafness. And that's often used, it's often used with Van Gogh as well, overcoming mental illness. The overcoming word is one that's very problematic. And it's interesting to think about not so much that the deafness or any other of these things that are supposedly meant to be overcome, but they are simply part of a very rich human neurodiversity. And that is part of creativity. Van Gogh's also supposed to, you know, he created all his great works in a very short period of time when he was suffering from quite extreme mental health issues. But you can also look at it in another way. So maybe also we can look at Beethoven in another way, that he didn't, as you were saying, he didn't overcome his deafness. It was an essential element of his creativity in the long term.
That's a very interesting thing. I mean, what I could do is read what happened when I went to see the manuscript of one of the late quartets, because I, in a way, I had that thought that maybe he couldn't have written this if he hadn't gone deaf. But I don't know if that's, you might have something to say to this, but shall I try reading it?
I mean,
Yes, please.
Yes, yeah, cool.
Okay, so this is the manuscripts of some of the late quartets are in Krakow, and we could explore why over a glass of wine. But anyway, they're in Krakow, and this is his manuscript 131, which is the C sharp minor. For those who know it, it's an extraordinary and revolutionary piece. And there's a violinist wrote his memoirs about. But being with Beethoven at that time, he was called Karl Holst, and he was part of the quartet that played the first performance of some of these things. While composing the three quartets, he was commissioned to write three quartets by Prince Galitzin. Such a wealth of new ideas flowed from his imagination that he had to write the quartets in C-sharp minor and F major too. "My dear fellow, I've just had another idea," he would say jocularly, with glistening eyes, out walking, and write a few notes in his sketchbook. So I went, I was in Krakow, and I went to this archive, and I'd asked to see it. One, on opening the manuscript of Opus 131 in the Music Archive, Krakow. Blue placard in a leafy street. The ordinary trance of morning light on flickering poplars, wind-blown jade, bentwood chairs with metal legs, bound manuscripts with marble covers. I never believed I'd meet him here. Still less that my fingers could touch his touch on the page. Two, another chance to be new again. Does being deaf break the chains? Could he have written this otherwise? Fugue and variation lead to rebirth, regeneration. The initial theme transformed into a thousand petioles and branches, all carrying the DNA of the first seed. Three, black cobwebs crossings out. Five sharps like wriggling insects. I can't imagine how any player could read this, but I recognize the voices, first solo, then together, now angry and loud, now gentle, I remember my father saying, you could tell from this everything of the human. Yearning, loving, in despair, then calm. Amused and jokey, sotto voce, beyond loss. Three bars slashed out. The way he wrote, espressivo. Here, over pale lines of the stave, the famous tortured entries, one by one. When the librarian is not looking, I kiss the corner of the page.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.